What is the value of studying history? Oh, that is our topic this evening. It's one that interests me a whole lot. Welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Our engineer this evening is Seamus McGrogan. And we're glad to have you listening to us this evening. My guest is Dr. Daniel Wilson, who is recently retired as a professor of history at Muhlenberg College. He's a native of Wisconsin and a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. He did his graduate work in American intellectual and cultural history at Johns Hopkins University, and after graduating, taught part-time for 1 year at Johns Hopkins and for another year at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Dan also worked at the Maryland Historical Society. Dan, I ask you this question. By the way, welcome back to our microphones.
Thank you, John.
Dan is a member of WDIY, hooray, and his wife, Carol, and they are listeners to our station here, and we like that. And the last time in our interview, I asked you, why is it not John Hopkins instead of Johns Hopkins? And you gave me an answer there. What was it?
Well, the man whose money was left to establish the university, his first name was Johns.
His first name was Johns.
I don't know why his parents named him Johns, but they did. So it's Johns Hopkins and not John Hopkins.
I'll bet you have not heard of another Johns
in your life. No, I have not.
And neither have I. So Dr. Wilson was appointed assistant professor at Muhlenberg College in 1978 and then to associate professor and tenured in 1986 and then to professor in 1994. He was awarded an American Council of Learned Societies Fellowship in the 80s, an NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, Summer Institute on Disability Studies, and a National Endowment for the Humanities Agency for Health Care Research and Quality Fellowship. During the spring semesters of 86 and 93, Dr. Wilson taught American intellectual history at Lehigh University. That's something I did not know about you, Dan.
Yes.
You had a couple of shots at Lehigh.
I did. It was fun. Taught some graduate students for the first time, which was enjoyable.
So let's get into our topic of history. And I think the most basic question, Dan, is why should we study history?
Well, I think we should study history because it tells us about our past. It tells us where we were, tells us something about what we have become. I don't fully subscribe to the notion that, as George Santayana, the American philosopher, put it, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it, because history never fully repeats itself. But history can alert us to some of the ways in which societies have fallen apart, as well as some of the ways in which societies and civilizations have succeeded. And knowing something about how to succeed or what can fail in a society and a civilization, I think, is important. It's important to know the good things about our past. It's important to know the bad things about our past, such as slavery, for example, so that we can make a better future.
All right, so you're tying our study of history into the future. I really don't think that it's true that we study history so that we don't repeat those mistakes from the past. We seem to be in a perpetual circle of just, we can't get rid of wars, conflicts all over. So does history actually teach us anything about how to get along better?
Well, I think it does. I don't think it can be applied to particular situations because the wars we have today don't replicate the wars of the 19th century or the early 20th century. We maybe learn something about why nations get into wars and ways in which some wars have been averted in the past through diplomacy, for example. I'm not sure that you can take the lessons of history and apply them one-to-one to any particular episode or event in today's world. The past is a very different place. Conditions were different. The people involved were different. Attitudes were different. So you can get some generalizations about the past, that peace is often better than war, diplomacy often works better than war. But also there are times when the nation probably should go to war for various purposes. So having that sense of the way in which the world worked in the past, I think, can help us think through the issues of today. It's not going to provide answers, but it can help us think through the issues of today.
Right. I also think it's fascinating to think where we came from. And there's a whole lot of emphasis nowadays on looking up your DNA and trying to figure out who your ancestors were. And all that just informs us of why we are the way we are today.
Well, and one of the things that I find fascinating about the DNA searches, and I've done mine, which didn't provide any surprises.
What did yours turn out to be?
Mainly German and English, which is what I knew from family histories. But very often people are surprised by the mix of their genetic background. And the one I love is Henry Louis Gates, who is the head of the African American Studies program at Harvard, and who does a program on PBS on ancestry. Gates discovered that he's more than 50% white when he did his own ancestry.
Whoa.
So here's a man who's clearly identified with African American history and head of the African American Studies at Harvard, who has a significant admixture of white blood in him. So we are a nation that's a nation of mixtures. Different ethnicities, different cultures have come together in this country, which is one of the things that I think makes it great. You're not stuck in your own ethnic identity, but very often many of us have significantly mixed backgrounds in our heritage.
Let's discuss how history has changed over the past 50 years since you were an undergraduate. I guess what we're talking about is the teaching of history at this point.
Well, I think it's the teaching of history, but also the writing of history. When I started college in 1968, history was still pretty much the history of dead white men, largely political history, some military history, but very little on the other aspects of people's lives, the way they lived their lives as men and women, the differences between a male's experience and a female's experience, the experience of slaves, the experience of Native Americans. That was largely relegated to the margins of the history texts that I studied. And most of the history professors that I had, both at in high school, in college, and in graduate school, for that matter, were white males. There were a few women.
That pertains not only to the study of history, but to most areas,
right,
correct?
Right. So today, it's a much... The discipline of history is much broader, much more inclusive. Those groups and societies and civilizations that were on the margins of my history textbooks 50 years ago have been brought in to the text, brought into the narrative of American history and world history. The history profession is now, I don't think it's quite 50-50 male and female, but certainly it's fairly close. The history department at Muhlenberg next year will, in fact, have 6 women and 4 men, which is quite a significant change.
That may be the first time that that's happened at this college.
Right. Yeah. So there's been a significant change in terms of what historians study, the stories that they tell, and in terms of the people who are themselves historians. Much greater representation by women, much greater representation in the history profession by African Americans, a growing presence of Hispanics and Latinos, and even a smaller percentage, but of Native Americans, so that the profession has diversified as well. And that's partly why the discipline of history has diversified, because you've got different voices writing history now than you did 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
So this is really an exciting time for young people who are interested in history to jump on the wagon because of all this diversity, I think. In fact, it makes it sound as if we were at a disadvantage having pretty much just one point of view back when we studied in the 50s.
I think you're right, John. I think there was that one point of view, and that was in many ways a distortion of American history, because there are many stories and many diverse stories that go to make up this complex society. And if only one version of that story is being told, that's a distortion.
Exactly. Dr. Daniel Wilson has recently retired as professor of history from Muhlenberg College. Let's talk about the history major in the 1960s, let's say. How does that differ from what we see today?
Well, the history major in the 1960s, you would pretty much focus either on American history or European history. There was very little opportunity to take courses in, say, Latin American or Asian history, or in this country, Native American history or African American history. And today, the history major offers a much more diverse opportunity. At Muhlenberg, you can still major in American history or European history or focus on American history and European history. But we now have a historian who teaches African history. We've had a historian who teaches Asian history, another one who teaches Latin American history, so that you can get you can focus on those areas outside of Western Europe and North America, if that is your interest. And we build into the major at Muhlenberg a requirement that students take at least one course in an area distant from their focus, so that they get a sense that there is more to the world than just the particular area that they're focusing on. So for somebody focusing on Latin American history, they'd need to take a course in American history or European history, for example, so they have a broader experience.
Right. Dan, I have a problem with our using the word America and American to mean United States. So I notice that you are talking about American and European history. So I have no problem with European. I would have a problem if the Italians were calling themselves Europe. So where do we go with this? Why can't we just say U.S.?
Well, I think part of it is a historical practice. The United States has, to some extent, assumed that it is the most important of the American histories, and it has had the political and diplomatic and military power to assert that with some success over the years. I think also part of it's linguistic. It's a lot easier to say American history than to say United States history. It just seems to flow off the tongue more easily. But you're right. I mean, to say American history is U.S. history ignores Canada. It ignores all of Central and South America who have an equal claim on being American history.
Exactly.
So there are some problems with it. I agree with you that there are some linguistic problems, but there are also some problems in terms of thinking about American history being exclusively U.S. history.
And sometimes I would like to change the term American to North American, but then we have the problem of Canada and Mexico, which are in there too. So there's no great solution to it. And also, Dan, people from abroad call us l'Amérique.
Right.
Or the Canadians talk about the Americans. And I want to shake them and say, don't you realize that you're Americans too? So it's just a term that's caught on.
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, the name of the nation is the United States of America. So it's easy just to shorten that to America. And you're right, the world has sort of picked up on that, even though it's in some ways a false name.
Right. When John Glenn, the astronaut, went up into space in 1962, and I was in France, and the woman who was hosting me for my junior year abroad, when she found out that news, said, Vive l'Amérique. That was just it. It was not États-Unis.
Right. So,
as an example. So, Dan, what was your graduate experience in history with your graduate studies?
Well, I went in to it thinking I would do something in intellectual history. As an undergraduate, I had double majored in history and English, and I was really interested. And I had done quite a number of courses in philosophy. So I was interested in a field that would combine my interest in English and philosophy with my interest in history. And that really came down to intellectual history. I had to do four fields, so my outside field was modern philosophy, and my history fields were American intellectual history, American social history in the 19th century, and American colonial and revolutionary history.
And this was at Johns Hopkins.
This was at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And my dissertation was a study of a Hopkins philosopher by the name of Arthur Lovejoy, who was an important early 20th century American philosopher and historian. And I discovered that there were 200 manuscript boxes of his papers in the Hopkins archives that nobody had looked at. And it was sort of like finding a nugget of gold.
Absolutely, saying, yes.
I just found my dissertation topic. And so my dissertation was a intellectual biography of Lovejoy, which I then, in the years after that, was able to transform into my first book, which was called Arthur Lovejoy and the Quest for Intelligibility.
Now, did they find these manuscripts from Lovejoy? They found them at Johns Hopkins?
Well, they were in Lovejoy's apartment. He died in 1962, and his executor found these papers and sort of collected them and deposited them in the Hopkins archives. So there was a rough guide, very rough guide to the archives. But nobody had been through all of the manuscripts. And one of the things I did, because I wasn't sure what I would find, it was I really created a catalog of the manuscripts so I could go back and find stuff that I, if I needed it.
That's a big job just in itself.
It was. And when I left Hopkins, I gave them a photocopy of my catalog of the archive. And it is still today the basis on which for the catalog of the Lovejoy papers. And they redid the, reboxed the papers a few years ago, but they kept them in the same order as my catalog. So they were quite grateful to have somebody else.
Yes, well, that
do
is
the catalog.
What an accomplishment. How few people who have been to graduate school see a project that they worked on last until the retirement from your profession. I mean, that's highly unusual. Folks, it's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Seamus McGrogan is working the board for us. And my guest, Dan Wilson, Dr. Daniel Wilson, will be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
We just heard Dr. Wilson talk about his PhD dissertation, and which led to his first book, an intellectual biography of the American philosopher and historian of ideas, Arthur O. Lovejoy. By the way, Dan, just to check and make sure you're legitimate here, what does the O stand for?
Onken, which was his middle name.
Oh, my good. O-N?
K-E-N.
K-E-N. Oh.
He was born in Germany. His father was a missionary in Germany. Right.
Well, maybe that's a name I just haven't heard before. And so this book by Dr. Daniel Wilson was titled Arthur O. Lovejoy and the Quest for Intelligibility, North Carolina Press, and that was in 1980. Dan, I have a question here of a technical nature. Almost all book titles now, and I'm talking about intellectual book titles, have a colon in the title.
Right.
You know, somebody said, that's what you learn in graduate school, how to use a colon in a title. You actually escaped that with your title.
Yeah, in that book I did, one of my other books as a colon. But what I learned now with these digitized search engines is you can't have the fancy part of your title before the colon. You've got to have a very direct statement of what your book is about before the colon, because that's what the search engines will pick up. They won't pick it up.
They'll pick it up earlier in the title rather than later.
Right, and if it's later, you won't get recognized by the search engines. Oh. So you've got to, they've really changed the way you think about what goes before and after the colon.
Another book featured a broader study of the impact of science on American philosophy in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and that one was titled Science, Community, and the Transformation of American Philosophy, University of Chicago Press, 1990. Again, you escaped the colon,
right.
Dan. This is highly commendable. During the past 30 years, Dr. Wilson's scholarship has focused on the history of polio epidemics in the United States. And in 2005, he published Living with Polio. There we got
a colon.
You couldn't escape it this time. The Epidemic and Its Survivors. Again, University of Chicago Press, which is quite prestigious. A study of the experience of having polio and living with its long-term effects. Dan, let's talk a little bit about that, because in the 1950s, you contracted polio.
Right.
And tell the listeners what you told me off the air about the length of time with the polio, the onset.
Well, the actual disease of polio, the actual infection probably lasts about 2 weeks. But if one is paralyzed by a case of polio, the effects, of course, last a lifetime. One of the interesting things about polio is that in an epidemic, only about 2 to 5% of the people infected will develop paralysis. So most people who are infected have an inapparent case of polio. And those of us who develop some paralysis are a small percentage of the actual number of people infected.
And we're talking the mid-50s.
Right.
It's the time of Jonas Salk,
right,
and the vaccine. And tell us a little bit about where you were living and how you didn't get the vaccine.
Well, I had polio in September of 1975. The Salk vaccine became available in April of
55,
sorry. The Salk vaccine became available in April of 1955. I was living in north central Wisconsin, a town called Wausau, which is about 90 miles west of Green Bay. And there was a shortage of vaccines in northern Wisconsin. And so the public health officials made a good public health decision, which was to give the vaccine only to children who were going to school, because they would be the most likely to come in contact with somebody who had polio. And I was a year short of going to school. I didn't get the vaccine, and I got the virus instead. So, as I said, a good public health decision, not so good personally. But
yes, right. Well, you have such a great attitude about it, though. Just poor timing is the way you have put it.
Yeah,
right.
Poor timing.
So that has led you to speaking about how the different areas of history have developed in the teaching of history. When I was in school, I never would have thought that I could take a course on the history of medicine. And in fact, that's what you have taught.
Right. Well, the history of medicine, I've been teaching the history of medicine since 1990, roughly, when I started doing the research on the polio epidemics. I decided a good way to give me a good background in medicine was to teach the history of medicine, because it would force me to come to terms with the context in which the polio epidemics occurred. The history of medicine is actually a fairly old branch of the history profession, and is taught mainly in association with medical schools. Hopkins has a very good history of medicine program, as does Yale and Harvard and the University of Michigan.
In their medical schools, you're
saying?
It's
usually associated with the medical school.
Right.
But what has changed in the history of medicine in recent years, in the last couple of decades, is much more interest in the patient, in the people who go to the doctors for care. The older history of medicine tended to be written by doctors, and they tended to be interested in the history of their particular profession, whether that was orthopedics or neurology or whatever it was they tended to write. And they tended to write a history of the successes of their field, how it became a field at the time they were active in it. What has happened in the history of medicine over the last several decades, and my book, I think, reflects that, is a much greater interest in the individuals who went to medicine for a cure, for to be cared for, a much greater interest in the patient and the patient's experience. So there have been studies, for example, of the patient's experience of sickle cell anemia, of diabetes, of tuberculosis, for example, and looking at the patient's experience rather than the doctor's experience. And that has really shifted a lot of the focus in the history of medicine. The other thing that's changed in the history of medicine is that that history is increasingly being written by historians, by men and women who are trained as historians rather than trained as physicians. The ones who I find sort of amazing are the men and women who get an MD, PhD. They get their MD degree and they get a PhD in the history of medicine. Having done one of those, I can't imagine doing both of them.
Makes us sound like dropouts.
That's right.
And Dr. Wilson, in 2007, published a volume that he jointly edited with Julie Silver, MD, speaking of Harvard University, called Polio Voices, an Oral History from the American Polio Epidemics and Worldwide Eradication Efforts. That's a mouthful. Dan, that's an oral history. So are those on tapes? Or
those were on tape. Julie Silver is a physiatrist who was working in the Boston area, and she found her mother, I believe, had polio. So she was interested in polio and had a lot of polio patients coming to her. And she found their stories fascinating, so she began a project to record them. And when she wanted to publish them, she'd put out some kind of notice, and I wrote her saying I'd be happy to help if I could. When she went to try to get the book published, the editor said, you really need to have, these are really interesting, but you need to have some historical context. So Julie asked me to write the historical introductions to the book and to the various chapters, and she provided the transcripts of the interviews with her patients. So it was really a collaborative effort, which was kind of interesting, John. I met Julie once in this, working on this book. I was at a history of medicine conference in Boston, and so we met for lunch. All the rest of our collaboration was done via email or telephone, and that's not something you could have done easily before the age of the internet and email, because we could be sort of an instantaneous communication. We could send documents back and forth. You didn't have to wait 3 or 4 days to get the document.
Exactly.
It was there in a matter of seconds. So the internet and email made that collaboration much easier to do at a distance. She was in the Boston area. I was in the Allentown area. And that's, again, one of the ways in which history has changed. It's much easier to collaborate on these kinds of volumes thanks to the internet and to email.
And my guess is that you and Dr. Silver now have advanced on to tweeting.
I'm not tweeting. I don't tweet and I don't do Facebook.
All right. I'm with you on that, actually. Well, we're the old guys. I'm John Pierce. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. My guest, Dr. Daniel Wilson, recently retired as professor of history at Muhlenberg College. We're exploring all kinds of questions about the teaching of history, the importance of studying history in the first place, courses that were taught in the past, and how the history teaching has changed in the last, say, half century. Dan, I sat in on two courses that you taught with your permission. You had your undergraduate students,
right.
And then you said, sure, John, if you want to come along and learn some things, come ahead. And one was called Women and the Family. Was that the exact title?
Women and the Family in America, yeah.
In America. Okay. Oh, not the U.S.
Not the U.S.
All right. So we're obviously talking about Venezuela and Chile and right. whatnot. Okay, I'm just teasing Dan now. But so that's another kind of course that I would not have expected to be able to take when I was an undergraduate.
Well, even when I was taking history as an undergraduate in the late 60s, that course didn't exist. Women's history is one of those new areas that has flourished in the last half century. Part of that is due to the increasing number of young women who became historians and who were interested in the history of women rather than the history of battles or diplomatic history or the other traditional kinds of history. And when I got to Muhlenberg in 1978, there were actually very few topical courses. Most of them were chronological courses, the United States from 1607 to 1763, and then the United States from 1763 to 1812, and so on, and the same thing in Europe. And one of the things that I did, and then later John Malzberger and some others who came after me, was to introduce the idea of topical courses. And one of the first that I did was the Women and the Family in American History. I had covered some of that material in my social history field at Johns Hopkins. But here I felt a significant number of my students were women, and I felt that this was a course that should be added to the curriculum. So I did some research, found the books that I could assign, and introduced the course to the curriculum. I must say there was some opposition on the floor of the faculty when it was introduced. One of my colleagues, who will remain nameless, got up and asked me where I was going to find enough great women to talk about for a semester.
Uh-huh.
And I pointed out to him that that was not really the focus of the course. It was more to look at the experience of all women, rich women, important women, immigrant women.
We hadn't had any women presidents of the country, so you couldn't go there. We hadn't had any CEOs to speak of at that point. That's what he was talking about.
Right. So women's history was one of those fields that really opened up a whole new area of discourse in history by looking at different kinds of material. When you start looking for women's history, you can find all kinds of material. Women were letter writers. They were diary keepers. They wrote articles for magazines. There's a wealth of material out there when you start looking for it. And the same is true of African-American history. And you develop other techniques. You develop the techniques of archaeologists. You use genealogy. You use anthropological information to try to get at the history of people who might not have left the kind of written record that a Thomas Jefferson or a George Washington left. But there are substantial materials out there if you start thinking outside the box and begin to look for them. They're just sitting there waiting for you to access.
And historians, when they find this, the way you found texts from Arthur Lovejoy start salivating
right
away.
Right.
It's wonderful. There's a project going on at Muhlenberg College, speaking of the college, right now with letters from recent graduates from World War II era.
Right.
Who have written back to the alumni office, and the alumni office wrote back to them. Somebody saved all these letters, and I think just a few years ago they resurfaced.
Right.
And so that's an interesting project that's ongoing, in which I have participated to some extent. Now, speaking about the course on women and the family, first of all, you didn't say women's history in America. You said women and the family. Because?
Well, a lot of the research at that time in the 80s, a lot of the books I was relying on to construct the course were putting women in the context of the family. And, you know, I think for much of American history, that's where most women experienced their lives, was in the context of the family. Increasingly, of course, women have moved into the world of work, although working class women, slave women, always worked. They didn't get credit for it very often, but they had to work to support the family. So I thought that a course that was more broadly constructed to look at women's in the context of the family and the way in which that changed over the course of American history would be an important way to go. I think the historians who have taught it after me have focused more directly on women's history because that material is much more available now.
Women in the workplace and women not necessarily connected to the family.
Right.
So, Dan, another thing that I think is interesting is that you, as a man, taught a course on women and the family. Now, I would have thought that a female colleague would jump on that and say, well, this is mine.
Well, there weren't very many female colleagues at that point to begin with. But I've also taught the course. I introduced both women's history and African-American history to the college. And I was challenged once in one of my African-American history courses. One African-American woman, the first day of class, asked me why I was teaching the course as a white man. And I think the answer for both women's history and American and African-American history is I don't accept the idea that you have to be what you're researching or teaching about. There are no ancient Greeks around to teach ancient Greek history.
Correct.
You'll appreciate this, a lot of United States historians teach French history or teach Latin American history.
We're going to stop right there because we need to take a break. Seamus is giving me the nod over there. And so this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Dear listeners, please stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
Back with my guest, Dr. Daniel Wilson, recently retired as professor of history at Muhlenberg College. Dan, you were there for how long?
40 years.
40 years. It's a good round number. Congratulations on a successful career there.
Thank you.
And by the way, to tell the listeners, Dan was one of the campus leaders. You know, you see a faculty of, say, 100 people, and there are certain ones who stand out as leaders. You were head of the Department of History
right. For
a while. Is that something that you enjoyed, or was that an onus?
A little bit of both. They're very enjoyable aspects of that, working with the students, working with their colleagues. They're also difficult because you're dealing with personnel issues. There can be some difficult times around those.
You can learn more than you need to know,
right. Really
want to know.
Right.
Exactly. Any position like that. We were talking just a minute ago about if you're going to teach Jewish history, you should be Jewish. If you're going to teach African history, you should be black. Now, you have come out against that idea.
Well, I think most historians write about things that they are not. I think it would really limit history to say the only thing you could, the only history you can write about is the history of your own ethnic group, your own race, your own nationality. People get interested in all kinds of things. I think the real key is to, A, have an interest, and B, in many ways, to be empathetic, to be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Now, I think there's also great value for women writing women's history and for African-Americans writing African-American history. They will bring a different and valuable perspective to that discipline that a white man, or in the case of African-American history, a white woman, cannot. So I think there's value in having those diverse opinions, histories written by people who belong to that group that they're studying and writing about, but also having the outside perspective. As long as you're empathetic and willing and able to put yourself in the position of somebody else.
Well said. Let's see. We're talking about the possibility of teaching about different groups. And once upon a time, a professor of mine teaching French literature said that a foreigner many times sees things in our language that we don't see.
Right.
And so that bolsters your argument that if you're interested in a topic and you know can learn something about it and then impart that to others, who cares what
right.
your appearance is or what your ethnicity might be.
Well, and I always urge students who are going to study abroad to take a course from an Englishman or a Frenchman in United States history so that they would have an opportunity to look at our history through the eyes of a British citizen or the ideas or eyes of a French citizen or German citizen, whatever. It would give them a different perspective on their own history.
Yes, indeed. In fact, you have make a nice little intro into something that I like to tell people. When I did my junior year abroad in France, I sat in on a course of a history of the United States, and it was taught by a French professor to this large gathering, amphitheater, of which is typical in Europe, of French students. And here I was just listening mostly my motivation was to hear this beautiful French and to take notes in French and do all that practice with the language. And he made two statements that have stuck with me through the years. One was, in looking at U.S. presidents, there was no outstanding president between Andrew Jackson and Theodore Roosevelt, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln. And I almost fell off my chair when he said that. Of course, we look around and we see all these things that are named Lincoln.
Right.
We have it on our coins. We have it everywhere. But that was his statement. And then he also, and this would be from a European point of view too, no matter that we had two world wars in the 20th century, the U.S. continued to have presidential election every 4 years.
Right.
As a U.S. citizen, I had never thought about that. Right. It was just automatic. Of course you would have elections.
Well, and even more amazingly, we had an election in the middle of the Civil War in 1864.
Yes.
We had an election in the Union, not in the Confederacy, and Lincoln was opposed by George McClellan, who had been one of his generals. And it was going into the fall campaign. It was not certain that Lincoln would be reelected. He was, of course. But again, I think that's even more amazing that we had an election in the middle of a civil war.
Yeah, exactly. No, you're right about that because the war was here.
Right.
Whereas the other wars were abroad.
Over there.
We have talked about what has been added to the teaching of history. So we have courses now on African history, also African American history.
Right.
We have courses on women's history, slave history. We have history of medicine, history of the environment,
right.
which is a course that you taught recently.
Right, which I also introduced to the college.
Okay.
That was sort of an interest of mine as an undergraduate. I got interested in environmental issues. And when I was an undergraduate, environmental history as a field did not exist. there were books written that have now been recognized as classics in environmental history. But the field really didn't exist. It really coalesced in the 70s and the 80s to become a recognized field in the profession of history. And it's fascinating the ways in which we've related to the land, related to the environment, the whole rise of the environmental movement, the movement west into the west, our use and abuse of the environment in the United States is really a significant history of its in and of itself.
So these are all courses that have been added through the years, and it makes it just seems to round out our perspectives on history a whole lot from what we were talking about before, military and political history. What has been lost as we have progressed through the years, do you think, in the teaching of history?
Well, I think one of the things that's been lost is a consistent narrative of the United States history and a narrative that everybody was exposed to. The history that you and I had was a history that had been in place probably since the middle of the 19th century in terms of its emphasis on politics and diplomacy and war. And virtually every student who went through high school, at least, and certainly on to college, was exposed to that history. It became a kind of common language, a kind of part of our culture. I think now, with the diverse emphases in history, there's much less of a common narrative that is taught at, on any level of high school or college level. And so it's much, we can celebrate the diversity, but what's lost to some of that extent are those things that hold us together as a nation and as a culture.
I find that among the younger generation, there's not a great appreciation of chronology.
Right.
Do you think that's fallen off through the years as well?
Oh, I think so, again, because you're not necessarily talking about the same chronology. The chronology, the important dates for women's history or African-American history or environmental history are not necessarily the important dates for political or diplomatic or military history. And so you get different chronologies. And so, there again, there's not a single story being told.
Right. We just want the students to know that there's a difference between 19th century and the Middle Ages.
That's helpful.
one of our colleagues said once upon a time that his view of the students' view of the Middle Ages was anything that happened before the Truman administration. Now, I think we could update that to maybe the Reagan administration or something. So we're talking about the teaching of history and why it's important and different ways to study history here on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. Dr. Wilson, my guest, wrote an essay, Passing in the Shadow of FDR, Polio Survivors Passing and the Negotiation of Disability. So we're back to the topic of polio. You have also published in 2009 a book called Polio Biography of a Disease, which is designed for student use in high school and for general readership. So talking about high schoolers, Dan, do you have a sense of change in the teaching of history at the high school level? We've been talking really about the college level.
Well, I think the teaching of history to some extent at the high school level has been diminished. And I guess my evidence for that is students interested in teaching at the high school level at Muhlenberg in social studies had to major in history. And I would go out, they had to be observed by somebody from the history department. And when I went out to observe their teaching, more often than not, they were teaching something other than history. Social studies, economics, geography, but not history. And I think these other areas have, to some extent, made inroads into history. Now, I know history is still taught to some extent in the high schools, but I think there's been a it's been diminished in terms of its central role in the high school education, and to some extent on the college level. When I started at Muhlenberg, you had to take two courses in history to graduate. Then it was reduced to one course. And
that means a semester course.
A semester course. And now, in fact, in the most recent curriculum revision, you can actually graduate from Muhlenberg without having a course in the history, which is, I think, unfortunate. But
absolutely
reflects curricular changes that are not just unique to Muhlenberg, but nationwide.
Dan, there's a topic that interests me, and that is one of the historical novel. Now, is that a nonsense expression, or is there such a thing as a historical novel? And then I'll tell you why I'm asking the question.
There is, and there can be some very good historical novels. There's one on the Battle of Gettysburg called, if I remember correctly, The Killer Angels, which is gets high marks from historians as well as fans of fiction. My wife introduced me to one on Elizabethan England called The Instance of a Finger Post, the author of which I can't remember right now, but I found it absolutely fascinating. And it didn't put me off in terms of the history. On the other hand, there can be historical novels. I remember trying to read James Michener's The Chesapeake at a time when I was taking colonial history. I didn't get beyond the first 30 pages because it was just off enough that it was grating on me. So there can be very good historical novels where the novelist has done his or her research. I think Hilary Mantel's novels about Thomas Cromwell, for example, which have gotten a lot of attention as novels, but was also on PBS as a TV show. They're very well done, but she's done her research and been able to take that historical research and transform it through her fiction into a compelling story.
But what she's done now as a novelist, whoever the person might be, is to play with history, if you want to say it like that, add to it things that are not probably didn't happen. How does that hit a historian like you?
Well, I'm more concerned, are there things that could have happened? She can put herself in the mind of Thomas Cromwell, for example, in ways that a historian is not going to, based on her understanding of the past and her reading of Cromwell. And if it's not jarring, if it's consistent with the historical, then why not? I mean, to some extent, historians do that too. Biographers do that as well. Maybe not as loosely as novelists do, but you often have to go as a historian and a biographer to extrapolate beyond the actual physical evidence that you have. Novelists do it a little differently, but if they do it well, write a compelling story that fits the facts and is plausible, why not?
That's it. It has to fit the facts.
Right.
Because, as you said, you were turned off by Michener's book because
the facts were just off enough.
Off enough.
It's like chalk on a blackboard.
Oh, please. Those are the old days, too. Oh, blackboard instead of a whiteboard. Or with markers. Huh?
Right. We're dating ourselves, John.
Yes, we are. Dr. Daniel Wilson, we're going to talk a little bit about his service in the community. He served for 9 years on the board of the Lehigh Valley Center for Independent Living, including 2 terms as president, and has recently returned to the board. So you took a little hiatus.
Right.
And
it was actually about a 9-year hiatus when I left the Center for Independent Living Board. I went on the board of Good Shepherd Rehab Hospital and served 9 years there. And then both the SIL and Good Shepherd require you after three-year terms to step off for at least a year.
Okay. Three-year terms.
Right.
Okay. And Dr. Wilson has served for many years on the board of Post Polio Health International. I like that term, post polio, because you told me off the air, and I think you might have repeated it for our listeners, that the polio epidemic itself, do we call it epidemic?
Yeah.
For a person, it lasts only a couple of weeks, but then it's the aftermath.
It's the aftermath, that's important. And that lasts a lifetime. And what polio survivors were discovering is that about 30 years after their acute illness, they begin to have new problems with muscle weakness, fatigue, pain, and so forth. And I now use a scooter to get around. In the year 2000, when I was in San Francisco for the NEH Institute, I walked all over San Francisco. I couldn't do that now. I use a scooter around campus and around to go to Wegmans and so forth. So,
right. So this is the Board of Post-Polio Health International, like the title. Well, Dan, believe it or not, our time is up here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Oh, thank you, John.
Thanks for coming over again to Eclectic South Bethlehem to entertain and to inform our listeners. And thank you and wife Carol for being staunch listeners and supporters of WDIY.
It's a great station.
Thank you. Let me tell the listeners that I was on the committee to evaluate, now this is back at Muhlenberg College, evaluate professors for promotion and for tenure situations. And I happened to draw, we just drew from a hat, and I happened to draw the name of Dr. Daniel Wilson. And one of my colleagues on the committee said to me afterwards, oh, you drew the easy one. Of course he was going to fly right through with flying colors. And that's exactly what happened. Thank you, listeners, for your attention this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thanks to Shaman McGrogan for his work on the board this evening. I'm John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.